Hello, and thank you for joining this Contemporary Pediatrics Medcast titled Personalizing Progress: New Data Shaping Care in Central Precocious Puberty. I am Dr. Jill Samis from Anna Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago and the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and I'm joined today with Dr. Aviva Sofer.
Hi, I'm Dr. Aviva Sofer. I am an associate professor at Columbia University Irving Medical Center, in New York, and I'm really happy to be here today.
Our discussion will explore the pathogenesis, clinical presentation, and psychosocial impact of central precocious puberty, or CPP. We will review key diagnostic steps, including when to refer to endocrinology, and discuss current treatment guidelines and individualized care considerations. We will also highlight recent long-term data on gonadotropin-releasing hormone therapy and its effect on growth, safety, and quality of life. Thank you for joining us. Let's begin. So to start with, Dr. Sofer, could you briefly review the pathogenesis and the hallmark clinical signs of central precocious puberty?
Absolutely. So before I go through the pathogenesis, I just want to go through a little bit of the epidemiology of central precocious puberty. So for a puberty disorder, it's actually relatively rare, although something that as endocrinologists we do frequently see, but it occurs in between 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 10,000 children. And it is 5 to 10 more times common in girls than boys. So to start with, puberty itself is defined as a process in which a child develops to become capable of reproducing and is distinguished by maturation of the genital organs, development of secondary sex characteristics, acceleration in linear growth velocity, change in affect, and in girls, menarche. So puberty is a result of reactivation of the hypothalamic gonadotropin-releasing hormone pulse generator and is characterized by increasing amplitude of bursts of GnRH secretion. And the reason I say reactivation is that children actually have a mini puberty in infancy, and the system is activated in infancy. It then becomes latent until puberty starts again, as early as age 8 in girls and age 9 in boys. So anyway, the way it starts is there is a substance called kisspeptin that is released in the hypothalamus, and signaling of kisspeptin leads to the GnRH release. The GnRH pulse generator is found in the KNDY neurons in the infundibular nucleus in the hypothalamus. That's a lot of detail, but it just gives us an idea of how complicated this process is. So then the GnRH bursts coming from the hypothalamus communicate with the pituitary gland, and the LH and FSH gonadotropins are secreted by the pituitary gland. And those hormones then signal to the reproductive organs to start maturing. So the first sign of puberty in girls, and generally puberty starts between ages 8 and 13 in girls, and the first sign of puberty is breast development. Whereas the first sign of puberty in boys is testicular enlargement. So girls are in a way more, their puberty onset is more noticeable than in boys because breast development can be somewhat of an outward sign, whereas testicular development, unless a doctor is examining a patient, is not particularly noticeable. So generally, a girl's puberty can be noted sooner than a boy's puberty. It's also important to note that there are kind of two processes that seem to be working in parallel, but maybe somewhat coordinated, and that is gonadarchy, which is maturation of the gonads, and adrenarche, which is maturation of the adrenal glands. And the adrenal glands also release different hormones, which lead to, and those hormones include DHEA, DHEAS, and androstenedione. And those lead to some of the secondary signs of puberty, such as body odor, hair under the arms, hair in the pubic area, and acne. So that's pretty much a background of what we would call normally timed puberty. Central precocious puberty occurs when the GnRH pulse generator is kind of awoken early, and that would be before age 8 in girls and before age 9 in boys. In girls, we do see some physiologic puberty starting even as young as age 7. We feel that between ages 7 and 8, that's kind of a gray area. So if a girl comes in and she's 7.5 years old and she's just developed breast buds, we are not overly concerned that this may be due to a pathological process. It's also important to note that girls only 10% of the time have underlying pathology leading to central precocious puberty, where boys, 50 to 70% of the time have underlying pathology leading to central precocious puberty. So when it comes to girls, we think about the implications of puberty more so than we think about worrying about something that's actually causing it. That's worrisome. Whereas in boys, we do a relatively extensive workup just to make sure we're looking for anything possibly that could be causing that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And when you're, if you were sorry. If you were to talk to a primary care provider and tell them a little bit about what we should be looking for on physical exam and when a patient should be referred to a pediatric endocrinologist, what advice would you give?
Absolutely. So first of all, before I answer that question, I want to mention that a lot of patients come to me self-referred. So parents might be worried about what they're seeing and kind of skip over their primary care doctor. And a lot of times they think their child's in puberty and they actually have signs of adrenarche without puberty, which is a very different situation, which we generally, of course, do a workup for, but generally don't treat for, whereas central precocious puberty, in many cases, we do treat. So a lot of times patients do come in with a little body odor or maybe some pubic hair, but in a girl, no breast development, and a boy, no testicular enlargement. And it's very reassuring to the parents because especially for girls, they're very concerned about menarche starting early. And it's very reassuring that if there's no breast development, really puberty hasn't started yet. But how, what we would recommend for referral would be really any kid who does start puberty on the early side, because there is a full evaluation that we would like to go through with these patients. So for girls, especially if there's early sign of breast development, but any sort of vaginal discharge, vaginal bleeding, or any signs of adrenarche in a girl under age 8 would definitely be a sign to refer them. Additionally, if you're monitoring growth and you see a growth spurt, that generally can be a sign that there's some sort of pubertal process happening. So if you see a child once a year and all of a sudden they jump from 20th to 50th percentile without like a lot of weight gain, because of course obesity can advance bone age and advance growth. That may be a sign also that puberty may be starting, and that would be a good indication for doing a full pubertal exam. So I would say that I would like to see a referral for boys and girls who start puberty earlier than age 8 in girls and age 9 in boys.
Thank you. And I think you really highlighted something very important there, which is the differences that we would see on exam between central precocious puberty with the onset of breast tissue and testicular enlargement versus peripheral precocious puberty, where we may see signs of adrenarche or other changes that are not truly central precocious puberty. I thought it was interesting how you brought up that some patients are self-referred because the parents are concerned. And I think that kind of leads to my next question, which is, what are some of those psychosocial challenges that we see in central precocious puberty?
Absolutely. So, it's been reported that to start with, boys who have precocious puberty much less frequently than girls, And actually, I think have been much less studied in this area, but boys with precocious puberty may have behavioral difficulties and poor psychological adjustment. So it's really important if you have a boy who all of a sudden starts acting out in school or, at home, that's something to think about, that maybe there's something else going on underlying. We have a lot more information about girls. Interestingly, the correlations seem to be more so with onset of menses or menarche than actual early puberty in girls. So the puberty in girls association with psychosocial effects is more of an association rather than an exact cause. But girls with early menarche do have higher rates of depression and antisocial behavior, and this can actually persist into adulthood. So this is really important to keep mind of. And because we know that early menarche can be associated with these things, that's another reason that we really need to look into precocious puberty early in all patients. Additionally, early menarche is associated with increased likelihood of teenage pregnancy, sexual and physical assault, and even reduced rates of high school graduation. So, precocious puberty can have a lot of effects if not dealt with really early, if the patient isn't, doesn't get the proper sorts of counseling or therapy or attention from their parents or doctors.
Thank you. And you kind of lead right into the next question here when you talk about the importance of recognizing precocious puberty early. How do you think an early diagnosis and timely treatment can influence both the physical and the emotional outcomes?
Sure, definitely. So, what I always kind of envision with kids who have precocious puberty is a third grade classroom where you have a girl who already is getting her period. She already is fully developed, and the teacher expects her to act like an adult almost. Like she or the boy like this is just treated like an older kid. And this is really difficult for these kids. And again, there are these associations with behavioral issues. So therefore, I think that early detection, early treatment can help prevent children from feeling different, from having to deal with things so early that they're not psychologically prepared for.
Great. And I think it's interesting that some of the studies even talk about the psychosocial outcomes or the emotional outcomes on the parents as well, that
Absolutely.
they're also affected, and that earlier treatment can help both the patient and the family, through this diagnosis.
It's true. There are some studies that show that mothers of daughters who have precocious puberty didn't accept their child as much before treatment, and after treatment, the mothers were much more confident in being a mother to these daughters and l much less anxious about it.
So, maybe move a little bit into talking about the treatment of central precocious puberty. Do you think you could summarize what the current treatment guidelines are and the available therapies right now for central precocious puberty?
Definitely. It's really important to note that, of course, we just spoke about the signs of precocious puberty, breast development in girls, testicular enlargement in boys. But sometimes, especially in girls, you can have breast buds and they can regress over time or not progress. So we really like to get an idea of is this puberty progressive? How rapidly is it progressive? And also, for example, we look at things like growth velocity, how fast are they growing, how advanced is their bone age, and what is their height prediction compared to their family. So, if we have a kid who has maybe a girl who has breast buds, her bone age is appropriate for her actual age, her height prediction is appropriate or maybe better than her family, we might not start treatment because we might want to observe. So that's definitely an option. If we decide that this is more rapidly progressive. If a girl is at risk of having menarche very early, where she's unable to handle it, then we are very fortunate because we have a very effective treatment, and that is the class of the GnRHa or gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonist therapies. And these are an incredibly effective and available sort of treatment that at this point in time come in many different forms. So for a lot for about 30 years, we've had the leuprolide acetate. Initially, the leuprolide acetate was the only treatment available, and it was an intramuscular injection that's still available. And the one we had initially was a 1 month formulation, where a child had to come into the doctor's office every month to get an injection to slow down their puberty. So as you can imagine, this was very difficult for families. And over time, we've gotten treatments that have been much more easy to use and much more convenient for families. So the intramuscular leuprolide now comes in 1 month, 3 month, and 6 month formulations. And apparently, there's a 12-month formulation that may be developed soon. These forms of treatment actually have the thinnest needles of all, so maybe less scary for kids. They're also pretty easy to use. They come with a pre-filled dual chamber syringe. There's no external mixing of ingredients, and they can sit outside for about 2 hours after mixing. So these are pretty easy to use, and now that they come in formulations that allow you to do them every 6 months even, they are a pretty good option for families. To then kind of switch over, the next type of medication that we were introduced to was the Histrelin acetate implant. This came out in 2007, and this is kind of quoted as a 12-month implant, which is surgically placed. It actually can last for even 2 years or maybe even 3 years. So the idea of surgery definitely sounds very daunting and scary, but it may not need to be done more than every 2 to 3 years. So it provides a good option for families that don't want to have to come into the doctor's office even every 6 months. Also, there are kids who are super scared of needles. So this allows us to do a procedure under anesthesia that they're not going to really know that's happening until after. And I would say the two drawbacks of this option are, first of all, there's no way to adjust this implant. So once it's in, we can't really change doses or change frequency. And also, sometimes there's some difficulty in getting the implant out when it needs to come out. So then, after that, we had about 10 years later, in 2017, the triptorelin pomoate was introduced, and this is a 6 month intramuscular medication. This one is really good. It has great efficacy. It's difficult to administer though, because it requires to be it requires specific training to give the injections. Additionally, it has to be injected right away because the substance hardens right away once you mix it. It also has the largest volume of all the treatments, all the injectable treatments, and volume actually is most associated with pain a patient might experience. So this medication, it's very, very good. It's very effective. There are a few drawbacks definitely with it. Then, most recently, we've had the subcutaneous leuprolide acetate. So this is in contrast to the intramuscular leuprolide acetate. So subcutaneous, of course, is great. It goes in much less deeply. It has also the lowest volume, only 0.375 cc's. It does have the widest gauge needle. But because of the low volume, it can go pretty fast. And it's every 6 months. So I feel like this may be the best option, for many families if they don't want to go through the surgical route.
Great. And, with all of these options that are out there, how do you help your patients make a decision about which of these GnRH agonists is the best for them?
Sure. So I think the first kind of decision point would be, do you want to do a surgical procedure that will last a few years? Or do you want to do something that's a little more temporary that can be adjusted a little and still kind of convenient because it's every 6 months? So that would be kind of my first decision point. Of course, sometimes we don't have a say because the insurance companies might, we might go through like an hour counseling a patient saying, which one is best for your child. And then we write the prescription, and then the insurance company says, no, we actually don't cover this and you must use that one. So sometimes we don't have a say, but when we do have a say, definitely I would first start to just decide between surgical versus injectable. And then I personally think most families do prefer the subcutaneous. But again, I think at that point, it's really up to whatever the insurance will cover.
When you're using this class of medications, do you have any long-term safety concerns? And what's the efficacy of this class of medicine?
So they all actually have similar safety and efficacy profiles over the first year of treatment, and they're known to be very, very safe. I think some patients will go online and they read things that are not scientifically based and get super nervous. But based on science and any research we've done and patient experiences, we found that these are very safe. The major issue we see is maybe a mild injection site reaction. Another thing to potentially anticipate is for girls, they might have one or two episodes of vaginal bleeding after treatment initiation, due to a transient increase in hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis activity or rapid withdrawal of estrogen. Some kids do get headaches, some kids get hot flashes, some kids get mood swings. Another thing we see, which, and actually, I want to kind of step back a little here because I think I might not have emphasized this enough. So one of the major indications for using these medications is to preserve final height. So to because a lot of times the bone age advances super quick in precocious puberty, and by giving these medications, we allow the bone age to kind of slow down in its progression, and we try to allow the kids to grow to where we'd expect them to be for their families. So because of that, though, the medication does kind of slow down the growth velocity, which is by design what it should be doing. But there are certain cases where it does slow it down a lot. And in some patients, we may recommend growth hormone treatment alongside. And the reason this is something really important to keep in mind is because growth hormone is very expensive, and a lot of times, unless there's a growth hormone deficiency, may not be approved by insurance. So that's just something we kind of, that's like kind of like very advanced endocrinology when we throw the growth hormone in, but it's just something to keep in mind that the growth velocity does slow down. Less common side effects can be sterile abscesses, which are more common in the intramuscular formulations, and these can be very painful. Of course, there can be some hypersensitivity that is re relatively rare. Again, relatively rare are seizures. And this can even occur in patients with no history of seizures at all. We also seen pseudotumor cerebri. Some kids have developed hypertension. So those are the side effects that we do see, but overall we think these are very safe medications.
Excellent. I love how you point out the importance of counseling our families to the data and the evidence, as opposed to what they may see online. Because I do agree, some of the things that are posted about this class of medications can be scary for patients.
Definitely.
And when you're using this class of medications and you're treating central precocious puberty, what markers are you looking for to show that you have good pubertal suppression and that you're getting the outcome that you want, sort of beyond sort of just chronologic age and bone age?
Absolutely. So another thing that I haven't mentioned yet is kind of the biochemical things we look at when we make the diagnosis of central precocious puberty. So what we generally recommend if we have a child coming in, of course, it's a clinical diagnosis in many senses, but to prove that precocious puberty is a clinical diagnosis, but to prove that it's central precocious puberty, we have to show that there are elevated gonadotropins. So, in girls, we generally measure in the morning an LH, an FSH, and an estradiol. And in boys, we measure an LH, FSH, and a testosterone. And the LH should be in the pubertal range. Even the estradiol and testosterone don't necessarily have to be, but we'd like an LH of at least 0.3. To say that this is a central precocious puberty. So sometimes we don't even get that value, and then we have to do a stimulation test or leuprolide stimulation test, which is actually a 2-day blood test where we inject leuprolide. We check bloods at baseline, at 1 hour, at 2 hour, at 24 hours, and we look and see if there's an LH preponderance with a higher estradiol and testosterone, that's more likely central precocious puberty. In girls, an FSH preponderance would mean premature thelarchy, which in itself is very different from central precocious puberty. It's onset of breast development, but not necessarily coming from the pituitary gland. But anyway, getting back to the question, so we use these same markers to monitor treatment. And we look for suppression. So we look for suppression specifically of LH. We look for suppression in girls of the estradiol and in boys of the testosterone. Another thing that we do monitor is growth velocity. We look at bone age. We look at how the height prediction might be improving with treatment.
Great. Not to ask a hard question here, but do you measure blood markers every time you see the patient while they're on therapy, or do you use more of your physical exam or some of these other markers of puberty to sort of follow them clinically?
I think that that's definitely a stylistic sort of thing. And also, how often do you see the patients is also stylistic and also practical. So, in general, I tend to end up seeing these patients twice a year. And I do check labs at each of those visits. And I try to time the labs to right before the next injection to see if. Even at the end of the treatment phase, like the 6 months or the 3 months, if there is still an effect or if, the LH and FSH have gone back to pubertal range.
Excellent. We had talked a little bit about what we consider precocious puberty, before the age of onset, before the age of 8 in girls and before the age of 9 in boys. And what are, when you're looking at treating a patient, what are some of the misconceptions about the timing of therapy initiation and discontinuation, in these children with central precocious puberty?
Yeah, so I remember when I was training that we were always taught that if we don't start treating precocious puberty before age 6 or 7, it's really not going to be effective. And I think since then, there have been studies that have proven that this is not always or, frequently the case. So there's a study that shows the benefit in height outcomes in, treatment of girls really at any age who have a history of precocious puberty. And not only that, you can continue treatment until even after a bone age of 12 in most girls. So, I think my advice would be that, if you have a girl coming to you and they're already 10 or 11 years old and, their height is being compromised and, psychosocially they're having issues, it's definitely not too late to start. We do think that at least 2 to 3 years of treatment is necessary to see the full benefits of the intervention. But definitely a girl who is still growing, who still has, a bone age, I would say below 11 to start with, I think those girls can benefit definitely.
Yeah, and I think that just really highlights how important it is to think about each of these patients individually and to make sure that we're tailoring the treatment, towards each patient as opposed to sort of a, catch-all
Exactly.
for all the patients.
Exactly. Definitely each case, especially in precocious puberty, is so individualized. First of all, there are cultural norms. So if a family or a girl feels that, maybe everyone in her family had menarche at age 10, that's 100% normal for them. And that might just, the age of menarche can definitely run in families. So that may not be a family to treat. But if you have the same exact anticipated age of menarche in a family where all the girls had menarche at 13 or 14, that's a totally different story. Or, for example, let's say you have a girl who, her parents are on the shorter side and her height prediction is 4'9" instead of 5 feet. That you may want to treat that patient as opposed to a girl, let's say, whose height prediction is like 5'8" and she might be 5'7" or 5'6" instead. So there's definitely very individualized treatment in all these precocious puberty cases.
And it sounds like we were probably trained pretty similarly in the fact that, you have to start before this time and you have to finish your treatment by, age 11 or bone age of 12. Whereas now we know from the literature that there is probably benefit to the final height outcome, in these other cases. And when you do stop the treatment for your patients or for your female patients, how do you counsel the family about when they might see, restarting of puberty symptoms, and how long will it take to achieve a menstrual period?
Okay, sure. So again, this is incredibly individualized. And just like with any family, even if they haven't been treated for precocious puberty, we do our exams and they ask, when is my daughter gonna start getting her period? Like, should I send, supplies to camp with her? And there's really no way to predict. We know that girls start pu that start me have menarche like around 10 or 3, 10 or 4, but everyone is different and we just don't know. And this is very similar. So we know that once we stop the GnRHA, the average time to menarche across studies is about 18 months, but the range is between 3 months and 3 years. So again, there's no way to know. And that's just something that we can counsel the patients about, but we can't give them a definitive answer on that.
Yeah, absolutely. That is always the hardest part, is trying to tell families what's going to happen next.
Totally, yeah.
And you had talked a little bit earlier about some of the more common side effects that we see when using these medications. What about more long-term side effects? I know they have a pretty good safety profile overall, but how do you talk with families about potential bone health issues in the future or any fertility-related concerns?
Okay, sure. So, let's see. So for bone age, I'm sorry, I'm going to start that one again. For bone density, it's important to keep in mind that bone mineral density accrual is greatest during the pubertal years, and children who have central precocious puberty, because they're bones are mature, their bone age is more mature, they actually start out with higher bone density than age-matched peers due to their bone age advancement. Once we start treatment with the GnRHA, the rate of bone density accrual slows, but it resumes to normal after treatment. So we actually don't see any long-term deficits in bone density reported in children with central precocious puberty. I know that this was a concern that the bone density drops with GnRHA treatment. However, it drops only because we're bringing them to their physiologic age. And then once they're finished treatment, they catch up and go back to where they should be compared to their family. It's important to also keep in mind that initially, the bone age with precocious puberty is generally advanced compared to chronologic age. Once the chronologic age and bone age are about equal, that may be a time that you might want to consider thinking about stopping because that can affect the bone density. But if, a child is monitored and we're watching them, they generally don't have an issue long term with bone density. Regarding reproductive function, we also feel, and this is something that the parents do look up online and see some scary things, but based on science and research, we don't see any deficits in reproductive function in boys or girls who are treated with GnRHAs. Ovulatory function and menstrual cycles are normal once menses resume post-treatment. Fertility and pregnancy outcomes are comparable to individuals who were never treated with GnRHAs. Since follow-up has extended to women in their 30s only, at this point, we don't know the effect on the timing of menopause. So we don't have all the information, but when it comes to fertility and pregnancy, we're not seeing any issues. We also need more studies regarding incidence of PCOS in patients with a history of central precocious puberty and whether treatment with GnRHA modifies this risk. And there are conflicting results about a lot of these matters from different studies due to variations in patient populations and study methodology. So this is the information we have. Overall, it looks incredibly reassuring. In boys, you see resumption of testicular enlargement within 1 year after cessation of treatment. Reproductive hormone concentrations and sperm counts are equal to that of the general population. And paternity rates and age of andropause, though, have not been studied yet. So we don't know that yet. There's also a concern about obesity with use of GnRHAs. And there are conflicting studies regarding the impact of GnRHAs on weight gain and BMI. Some have reported weight gain during treatment, but others have not seen a significant change in weight or BMI. Just like with any patient, it's really important to counsel patients before treatment about healthy lifestyle, especially since height growth velocity does slow and that might. You know, if you're used to growing really fast, you might be used to eating more just to keep up with how you're growing. And then once you start this treatment, your growth is going to slow down and you probably need fewer calories. So it's important just to, keep in mind healthy lifestyle like we would for anyone else, like exercise every day for at least 30 minutes, and types of food. And it's also important to note that women with a history of central precocious puberty have similar weights and BMIs to those in the general population. So that's reassuring as well.
Thank you. That it's so much to counsel patients when you're talking about this therapy. Not only are you trying to decide which product to use, but all of the, safety data and long-term safety data. I think you did a great job summarizing that.
Thank you.
As far as the sort of psychosocial aspects, to kind of jump back to that, how do you support your patients that may face a stigma or psychosocial stress related to early puberty?
So I think, education is really, really important. And I'm really happy to hear that so many schools have really great programs starting at very young ages about puberty. So I think this is really, really important because I think probably when I was in school, I don't even know that we had this, but they probably started like in middle school, or maybe high school even. But I've heard of like third graders now having discussions about puberty, which initially sounds a little jarring, but for, these patients who might be starting again. We said age 8 can be normal, so third grade might even be too late. But I think education is extremely important. I think it's also important for kids to know that puberty is a totally normal process. We all have to go through puberty. Of course, kids going through puberty, whether or not it's early or, regularly timed, they might feel very self-conscious, and it's really important to emphasize to them that this is, a normal thing that everyone goes through. Again, it's really important to do an assessment to see if someone has central precocious puberty, how their reaction to it is, and intervening with the treatment, but also recognizing if you see any signs of anxiety or depression, definitely recommending that they see a trained therapist, psychologist, social worker to support the family through this.
Wonderful. And I guess some final thoughts from you. So, what is your outlook on the evolving treatment landscape for central precocious puberty?
I think, the past 10 to 20 years, we've seen so many new treatments. And even, in my career as an endocrinologist, I remember when we were just starting to use 3-month leuprolide, and now we have so many different options. So I think it's great that patients have an option between a surgical procedure, between IM, subcutaneous, the intervals. But I also have done some reading, and there seem to be maybe some new treatments that might be on the horizon. So I did mention the 12-month leuprolide, and actually there may be a 12-month triptorelin, so two new things to look forward to. There also may be a new approach to therapy with a GnRH agonist that comes in a pill form. So staying away from injections and surgery, we might be able to treat kids with pills. So far, this medication has been studied in men with prostate cancer, and it shows excellent efficacy and safety in that population, and has been approved by the FDA for men with prostate cancer. And there will likely be clinical trials using this medication for central precocious puberty in the near future. So that's super exciting that there might be a pill. Also, I think in general in medicine, we're kind of heading toward this like personalized medicine. And we touched briefly on kisspeptin, and then there are a lot of genes, including the kisspeptin gene, that have mutations that cause what we call monogenic central precocious puberty. And that's an area that's being looked at for specific treatments for people with mutations in the kisspeptin gene, or for example, the MKRN3 gene, which is the most common gene mutation that we see in precocious puberty. So we're learning a lot more about the timing of puberty and how to treat, as we said, individuals rather than the whole population.
That's excellent. I think this is all so exciting to hear, what's coming up in the treatment of central precocious puberty. I want to thank you very much, for talking with me today.
Thank you.